providing the library with such support for our new exhibition, The New York World of Willa Cather. And I know that Harriet would echo this. These guys have been simply amazing. I don't know how many questions they've answered over the course of these, the past year. It's really wonderful to have back here and for this program. So.
As you know, I've already figured out this is going to be a tag team thing. And I guess I'm it first. Appropriately enough for our purposes, Willa Cather first arrived in New York in February. It's February 1898. She was 24, living in Pittsburgh, working at a newspaper, and doing drama criticism. She was making her way. She certainly knew then that whatever direction her career in life would take, that she was going to be Willa Cather. That's an idea we want to offer you immediately. This Willa Cather was a person with drive, ambition, and focus, along with a bit of trepidation. About 20 years later, she would make the same assertion about her character Eden Bower in Coming Aphrodite, arguably her best New York story. Bower is also a young woman starting out, and Cather writes of her that the one thing she knew, that she was going to be Eden Bower. She was like someone standing before a great show window full of beautiful and costly things, deciding which she will order. She understands they will not all be delivered immediately, but one by one, they will arrive at her door. Cather came to New York to see plays, and while she was here, she had lunch with Helena Modjeska, whom she judged to be one of the greatest actresses at the time. Coming Aphrodite captures just what Washington Square was like when Cather moved there to live in 1906. And in her 1926 novel, My Mortal Enemy, one of her sharpest critiques of being alive and being human, she recreates the Madison Square of 1898 when she first visited and lunched with Modjeska, who appears in. Its story is told by Nellie Birdseye, 15-year-old from Illinois, who describes her own first winter arrival in New York, crossing on the ferry from the Jersey station, as people coming from the West End did. The description doubtless offers Kathy's own anticipations, recollected from 1898. The boat was pulling out, and I was straining my eyes to catch, through the fine, reluctant snow, my first glimpse of the city we were approaching. We passed the Wilhelm der Grosse, coming up the river under tug, her sides covered with ice after a stormy crossing, a flock of seagulls in her wake. The snow blurred everything a little, and the buildings on the Battery all ran together, looked like an enormous fortress with 1,000 windows. From the mass, the dull gold of the World Building emerged like a ruddy autumn moon twilight. We only arrived here then, as Kathy probably did, crossing the Hudson, first glimpsing the city lights through a fine, electric snow. E.B. White, in his Here is New York, argues that there are three types of New Yorkers, as I'm sure you know. People who are born here and stay, commuters who live elsewhere and work in the city. Third, Mrs. White, there is the New York of the person who was born somewhere else and came to New York in quest of something. That is, people like to look at. Happily, she is among those white names, saying that as he wrote his essay, he was about 34 blocks from the street Willa-Cather lived in when she came to New York to write books about Nebraska. That's not quite right, but it'll do. That's the story we're going to tell you tonight.
On May 1st, 1903, Willa-Cather came to New York to meet S. McClure. She was living in Pittsburgh and teaching high school, but trying to become a writer. Her first book had just come out, a little book of poetry called April Twilights that she published with Richard Badger for a fee. She also had a manuscript for a collection of short stories. She had submitted some of the stories to McClure's magazine in the past, but they were rejected and returned. But she had sent them again that spring on the advice of an old friend in Lincoln, Nebraska, and this time she got S.S. McClure's attention. That old friend, Will Jones, was the editor of the Nebraska State Journal, and he aggressively promoted Kathy to newspaper syndicate man Henry McClure, cousin of the magazine editor. The cousins talk, and now here was Willa-Cather in New York, listening to S.S. McClure hold forth at his office on East 25th Street, hearing that he will publish the book manuscript, that he'll publish the stories in his magazine, and that he will take anything she writes in the future. Learning that his magazine had rejected her stories in the past, McClure called two manuscript readers into his office and asked them to explain their behavior right in front of Cather. Cather told her friend Jones, quote, "Surely I sat and held my chin high and thought my hour had struck. At 10 o'clock last Friday, I was not much afraid of streetcar accidents and things, but when I left the office at 1, I had become worth saving." S.S. McClure was true to his word. His magazine published several stories, starting with The Sculptor's Funeral in January 1905. And Cather's first book of stories, The Troll Garden, was released by McClure, Phillips, and Company in March of that same year. Cather was just beginning to enter into the world of the literary elite, a status underscored by the invitations she received to a gathering of writers, mostly, celebrating the 70th birthday of Mark Twain. On December 5th, 1905, Cather joined a group of 170 people at Delmonico's for the occasion, including luminaries William Dean Howells, Mary E. Wilkins Freeman, Andrew Carnegie, Francis Hodgson Burnett, Charles Chestnut, Emily Post, and Owen Wister. She was a teacher from Pittsburgh who had recently published a book of short stories, and it isn't clear how she got the invitation. Perhaps McClure encouraged it, or perhaps the connection was to her friend Dorothy Canfield, another guest at the party, who would emerge as an important writer, but who in 1905 had published little. The New York Times suggested that the authors present at the occasion were selected to represent all regions of the country, and that many were women. Perhaps a woman who had published stories set in Nebraska helped with the goal of geographic distribution. She remembered years later that she got an invitation because someone told the host of the party that she had a future, and that, quote, "kind Pittsburgh woman took my classes at the high school for 4 days to enable me to come to New York for the party, and she loaned me $50 to have a good dressmaker make the dress in which I appear. I had money in the bank, but I wouldn't use it for anything so frivolous. Cather forged no known lasting relationships at the well-publicized gathering, but she did, like all of the guests, get a foot-high plaster bust of Twain to commemorate the occasion.
That meeting between Cather and McClure that Andy just described had a context, certainly. After creating the first literary syndicate in the 1880s, McClure launched the magazine he named after himself in 1893. I've always liked the fact that he founded the magazine in 1893 in the midst of the Depression. And had built it into the country's leading monthly with circulation approaching 400,000 each month. Owing to his success selling advertising, McClure lowered the original cover price from 15 cents to 10. A year's subscription then was a dollar. McClure's published and prided itself on its quality fiction and poetry, on significant autobiography, biography, and reminiscence, on topical subjects generally, but most especially on its exposés of contemporary graft, corruption, and social problems. McClure became known as the best editor in the country because of his innate curiosity about just about everything, his ability to generate story ideas, and his willingness to allow his writers to devote the time and money they needed to get the story right based on the facts they had confirmed. The political and social articles McClure's published exposed the excesses of the Gilded Age, and so caused the president of the day, Theodore Roosevelt, as is well known, to famously name this writing muckraking. McClure had hired Ida Tarbell in 1894 and set her to work on extended and popular biographies of Napoleon and Lincoln, then on the history of the Standard Oil Company. That series was still running when Cather and McClure met. A second famous muckraker was Lincoln Steffens, whose The Shame of the Cities exposed corruption to local governments across the country. Another was Roy Stannard Baker. Each became famous through McClure's. That said, McClure was hard to work for. And in early 1906, there was a blow-up. Tarbell and almost all the staff were gone. Having hedged his bets, McClure had Cather waiting in Pittsburgh. They had kept in touch. As Andy said, he had published her first book of stories, Trollgar. She had been his guest in New York for a week in 1905, and he probably arranged that invitation to Twain's birthday party. They got on famously, McClure's biographer has written, each responding to something special to the other. He descended on Cather at Isabel McClung's family home in Pittsburgh, where she was then living, stayed for dinner, charmed everybody, and convinced her to come to New York to work for McClure. She was at her desk on East 23rd Street in early May. Cather certainly wasn't a muckraker. As one of her biographers has said, she found social reformers were dull people. But her new job and all the effort and focus it required of her gave her an unequaled position to participate daily in what was happening in literature, art, and publishing in the vortex. Initially responsible for general editorial work, she handled poetry and fiction, read and edited manuscripts, commissioned pieces, corresponded with authors. She worked to get a massive monthly out under trying circumstances and ongoing flux. McClure had gone out and hired seven men in addition to Cather at the same time. That she succeeded brilliantly, and that's again one of her biographies, as a woman in a man's world is clear, and equally clear is that she made her mark very quickly. In 1907, McClure had decided to send her to Boston to fact check and rewrite an important and controversial 14-part series McClure's had bought and had begun that month. Mary Baker G. Eddy, The Story of Her Life and the History of Christian Science. Under deep scrutiny by the church's proponents, who at one point tried to block publication, McClure relied on Cather to verify the facts they had and to get more and to get the story right. She did not disappoint him, but this was not the sort of writing she wanted to do. For the rest of her life, she disavowed the series as her own. Yet going to Boston for most of 1907 and into 1908 had compensations. There she met Ferris Greenslade, who would be her editor at Houghton Mifflin and a lifelong friend. She met Louise Imogene Guiney, a poet she had long admired. She met Mrs. James T. Fields, Annie Adams Fields, widow of the famed publisher of Ticknor and Fields. Through her, Catherine made a brief but intense friendship with Sarah Orne Jewett, an influential relation that shaped her trajectory as a writer.
Willa Cather met Edith Lewis in Lincoln, Nebraska in 1903. Cather was in Nebraska while on summer vacation from her teaching job at Allegheny High School in Pittsburgh, and Lewis, having recently graduated from Smith College, was in her hometown trying to figure out her next steps. Those steps included moving to New York and trying to find a job there. Any kind of job, Lewis remembered. Cather was interested in this bright college graduate who was bold enough to move to New York and make her own way. Lewis was interested in this emerging writer who spoke to her with eagerness and focus. Quote, "It was impossible for Cather to make a perfunctory approach to anyone," Lewis wrote. "She wanted at once to get beneath the surface, to find out what they were really like." That meeting in the summer of 1903 created a connection that lasted until Cather's death in 1947, and the relationship was formed, at least in its beginning, through New York. In the few years before Cather moved to the city, she visited Lewis several times and stayed with her in her apartment on the south side of Washington Square. When she moved in 1906 to take a job at McClure's, she selected an apartment in the same building as Lewis. For the first few years of her job with McClure, Cather was often in Boston, working on the series on Mary Baker Eddy and the Christian Science Church that was published in the magazine in 1907 and 08, as Bob said. And then she traveled to Italy for a few months in the summer of 1908. When she came back to New York in August, ready to settle back in at McClure's, she was also ready to find a new place to live. That fall, Cather and Edith Lewis moved into a new apartment together at 82 Washington Place, a half block off Washington Square. She wrote her friend and mentor, Sarah Orne Jewett, about the new apartment, noting that she and Lewis were not living, quote, dreamy, idle lives, but were industriously taking care of themselves, cooking your own food for most meals, and only having, quote, a maid come in to clean 2 days a week. The cooking, Cather wrote, helped both of them take their minds off office troubles. Both Cather and Lewis worked at McClure's at this time. Lewis was an editorial proofreader at the magazine from 1906 until 1950. McClure's office was a challenging place to work and demanded a pace that Cather found exhausting. Quote, "It's all like going around the world in a railway train and never getting off to see anything closer," she wrote Jewett in December. But both women found solace in their lovely Greenwich Village apartment. Lewis remembered it as, quote, "one of the most charming places in New York that had a youthful, lighthearted, and rather poetic mood in those days before the automobile, the radio, the moving picture, and before two wars." Cather, too, remembered her early days in the village with pleasant nostalgia, recalling them in this description in her 1920 story, Coming Aphrodite. "The fountain had but lately begun operations for the season and was throwing up a mist of rainbow water, which now and then blew south and sprayed a bunch of Italian babies that were being supported on the outer rim by older, very little older brothers and sisters. Plump robins were hopping about on the soil. The grass was newly cut and blindingly green. Looking up the avenue through the arch, one could see the young poplars with their bright, sticky leaves and the brevoort glistening in its spring coat of paint, and shining horses and carriages, occasionally an automobile, misshapen and sullen, like an ugly threat in a stream of things that were bright and beautiful and alive." The fondness with which Cather and Lewis recalled the village in those early years must have been mixed up with their emotional memories, with the excitement of their work, their growing confidence in their ability to make it in New York, and their pleasure at beginning nearly 40 years of sharing a home together.
When Cather first went to Boston to begin work on the Eddy series, she wrote to McClure saying that she had brought his good letter along with her to give me courage. "I have read it over many times since I have been here," she continued, "and take great comfort in it. It does help me so much to feel that you trust me and feel such interest in the work I am trying to do. Though intent, ambitious, and capable, Kathy was not without doubt, as I said. And S.S. McClure responded at this time by encouraging her significantly. Years later, she still referred to him as her chief, and she always acknowledged that he had done more favors for her than she could count. He promised her, as Andy just said, he promised her 6 months in Europe on the company once the series was done. She got over four. Traveling to Italy with McClure, but four. But she came back to be managing editor of McClure's. Right? And she was more successful in that job than any of its former incumbents had been. And given what I told you about McClure, he went through quite a few. Cather managed the Mercurial and McClure, but did so at some personal cost. Her time as managing editor, which was 1908 to 1911, was characterized by overwork, near exhaustion, and very little writing of her own to show for it. Some have seen McClure intent on keeping Cather focused on the magazine, telling her that she would not amount to much as a writer, that she was an excellent magazine executive, and she should just leave it at that. The known facts bear this out, certainly they said that. But the relationship between the two, I think, is much more complicated. One act in particular seems to embody that complication. When, in 1912, just when Cather was herself pulling away from the daily office work at McClure's, she stepped up to help her chief. McClure had been unhorsed, that's his word, pushed out of his magazine because of the mass debts he had accumulated. Despite all appearances, McClure did not make a profit after 1906. So Cather agrees, as Carolyn said, to write McClure's autobiography. I just love that. She wrote his autobiography. It was first a popular series in McClure's, where it gave the impression that he was still very much in control, and then a book in 1914. Ironically, given Cather's authorship, and it was well known that she had done so, it was titled My Autobiography. The fee McClure was owed for the magazine series went to his debt. He got to keep the book royalties. And as Cather well knew, he needed the money. This is my greatest New York moment in Cather's life. It happened here during the winter of 1912-13. By then, she had published her first novel, Alexander's Bridge. She had written but not yet published a second of Pioneers, the one she would later call her first real novel, the one that would turn her focus west to Nebraska. Cather had just moved into the apartment she shared in 1927 with Edith Lewis on Bank Street, just off Greenwich Avenue in the West Village, the very best place for her writing while they lived in New York. S.S. McClure came to this apartment and told Cather his life story. His story was like Horatio Alger. It really was. He had been telling it for some time on the lecture circuit. This time, under the duress of necessity, he had in Cather an empathetic audience of one. She listened closely and carefully, predisposed to McClure's then difficult circumstances. Cather produced My Autobiography, a book roundly praised across the country, and especially by those who knew McClure well, for she had captured on the page his personality and manner of speaking. More importantly, Cather adapted this experience and used it to shape her own fiction. A few years later, Cather wrote a story series she called Office Wives, derived from her time at McClure's, and McClure himself. In a story called Her Boss, Cather recreates McClure telling his story to her through Paul Lannan, successful New York lawyer who, faced with a terminal illness, withdraws from his unsympathetic family and dictates his life story to a young secretary who listens humanely and sympathetically. While doing this, Wen had become again the mild, contemplative youth he had been in college, before he had a profession and a family to grind for, before the two needs that shape our destiny had made him pretty much what they made. This passage looks back as well as forward in Cather's fiction. Here is S.S. McClure, her chief, a man who would never again enjoy the prominence as an editor he had had previously. the unhappy marriage of Dr. Archer from Archie from The Song of the Lark is there too. But most especially, Catherine foresees Jim Burton, the narrator of My Antonia, who tells the story of his Antonia in the same empathetic way Kathy tells McCord. And this foresees the stories, this foresees two of the stories of Tom Outland and Godfrey St. Peter in the professor's house. There Tom waits until he is sure that St. Peter is a suitable empathetic audience of one for his life story before he tells it to him in the novel's second section, Tom Outland's story. All of these men in the telling come again, at least for a time, the mild, contemplative youth that had once been. Arguably, Capa derives some of her most powerful technique from the writing of McClure's autobiography, Winter in New York on Bank Street.
Willie Catter's life changed dramatically in 1912. The changes were in some ways visible in the moment, felt in real time, but the significance of that year is really only discernible in retrospect. Early in the year, while she was recuperating from surgery for an unknown ailment in Boston, her first novel was appearing serially in McClure's magazine. Published there as Alexander's Masquerade, it was published as a book by Houghton Mifflin that April as Alexander's Bridge. She had also written a long story, one with quite a different tone than the mannered Boston-London love triangle of Alexander's Bridge. The story called The Bohemian Girl was set in the Czech community of rural Nebraska and was purchased for a tidy sum by McClure's for publication that summer. While McClure was supporting her emergence as a fiction writer, her relationship with the magazine was changing. She had stepped away from active editorial work in the fall of 1911, and she planned to take a leave of absence and return as a staff writer. After wintering in Boston and Pittsburgh, she went west in April, visiting her brother Douglas in Winslow, Arizona. She spent several weeks in Arizona, exploring the desert, the canyons, the cliff dwellings, rambling at a different pace in a vastly different environment. The time in the West affected her deeply. Quote, "I have not written a line since I left New York," she wrote S.S. McClure in June, "but I have such a head full of stories that I dream about them at night." She felt renewed and refreshed. Quote, "I've never been so happy since I was a youngster as I have been this summer. Back in my own country with my own people, I feel as if my mind had been freshly washed and ironed and were ready for a new life. I feel somehow confident." That confidence, seeded by success with her writing early in the year and nurtured by a spring and summer in the West, would prove crucial. She returned east that fall, spending a lot of time at the home of Isabel McClung and her family in Pittsburgh, a place she loved to go to write. She was working on a story she called The White Mulberry Tree, set in Nebraska among Bohemians. By September, though, she realized that she had the makings of something else, and she combined this new story with an unfinished manuscript she had worked on months earlier. These fragments came together to make the novel O Pioneers, a book whose tone, ambition, and characters so eclipsed Alexander's Bridge that years later, as Bob referenced already, Catty would call it her second first novel. The book, born out of the confidence of 1912, would propel Catter out of a life as an editor and into the life of a professional novelist. As she was writing the manuscript of O Pioneers, Catter was also figuring out her life in New York with Edith Lewis. In October, they left 82 Washington Place and found a new place to live. She wrote a friend, "Since I wrote you, I've been in New York twice, have leased and moved my effects into the ideal, the perfect apartment. Large, old-fashioned, roomy, one flight up, good fireplace, good windows, good woodwork, wide stairs up, and if you please, number 5 Bank Street, off Greenwich Avenue, 2 blocks from Jefferson Market." A few months later, after getting settled, Catty wrote her aunt, "At last I have an apartment that is roomy, quiet, and suits me perfectly." Lewis had found the apartment while Catty was traveling, and they paid $42 a month for it. 5 Bank Street with 7 big rooms, generous windows, and high ceilings was where Catter and Lewis lived until 1927, the site of Catter's most productive writing years. As 1912 ended, Catter had a new home, the makings of a new novel, and was, at age 39, becoming a real writer.
After she finished writing McClure's autobiography, Catter published O Pioneer, as I've said, and was at work on The Song of the Lark, her most autobiographical novel. It appeared in 1915. to some significant notice. Now, they then turn to a story at the Southwest, one of the stories Andy refers to, and she called it the Blue Mesa, and she found the material intractable. After a visit home during the summer of 1916, Kathy returned to New York, fired up with the idea for My Antonia, and set about writing it. One of the ironies of that retrospective novel, the book Kathy knew was her greatest contribution to American literature, one that has never been out of print since it was published in the fall of 1918, is that it came together in the midst of the Great War. The review it got in the New York Sun, for example, one that particularly pleased Catherine, illustrates its time by its many military allusions. Catherine had a cousin at home, G.P. Catherine. He was a person whose life had been one failure after another until he found his way into the American Expeditionary Force as a lieutenant from the cornfields of Nebraska, going to France to fight for an idea. Cited for bravery, he was killed in action at the Battle of Castigny in May of 1918. Cather had not been close to GP, although during a visit home during the harvest in 1914, she spent time with him and had come to understand him, his difficulties and their own differences as kin. Years later, she wrote of his death, wondering that anything so glorious could have happened to anyone so disinherited of hope. And says, too, that some of me was buried with him in France, and some of him was left alive with me. She had to write about it. G.P. became Claude Wheeler in One of Ours, the next novel. As soon as the soldiers came back from France, while My Antonia was still being reviewed, Cather was seeing them in New York and writing about them, saying that they are so jolly and modest and amused at everything, just all that one could want them to be. She wrote in her letter, that's in December 1918. A funny little Marine is coming here for dinner tomorrow night, who never wears his croix de guerre, except indoors because people look at him so. Beyond soldiers at dinner, Cather visited the wounded. She later wrote to Dorothy Canfield Fisher that she got a lot of detail in that novel in the hospital here, winter of 1918. When a lot of Western boys lay here in the polyclinic all winter and were glad to see me. Such clear, vivid memories came back to sick men. Cather also asserts her own personal commitment to these wounded men, writing, "You have to give out a whole lot to make people remember aloud to you. I saw many, many well ones too, but the sick ones often talk like men in a dream, softly remembering dead lives."
Alfred A. Knopf started his eponymous publishing firm in 1915. He was 23 years old. Within a few years, with his new wife, Blanche Wolf Knopf, as his partner in the firm, he had established Alfred Knopf, Inc. as a publisher of beautifully designed books. Willa Cather noticed. Since Alexander's Bridge in 1912, she had published with Houghton Mifflin in Boston. But after the publication of her fourth novel with the firm, My Antonia, she began to get a little restless. She saw her stature was growing in the literary world, but she didn't think Houghton Mifflin shared the observation. They didn't seem to put much into their promotion of her works, and her sales remained modest. She decided she wanted to meet Knopf, a young publisher who, Cather felt, quote, had set out to do something unusual and individual in publishing. So she sought him out at his office in the Candler Building on West 42nd Street. Cather observed in Knopf a kind of focused, energetic, creative personality that she was drawn to. Quote, he seemed to be going into his business as if it were an exhilarating sport of some kind. His talk was amazingly free and human. No timidity, no evasions, no string of qualifying phrases, Cather recalled. Something interesting would go on here, and I felt sure. Of that I felt sure, and I wanted, in some capacity or other, to be in on it. She was pleasantly surprised that he was dedicating his energies to respected but unfashionable writers. He was a person who, like Cather herself, felt an ardent commitment to the works he thought were of high quality, and he wanted to present those works as distinctive and attractive physical objects. But Cather wasn't only attracted to his dedication and his taste. She saw that the firm was able to really sell books. They advertised not only individual titles, but their writers too, using reprinted reviews and other strategies can often raise the public stature of their writers, creating a reputation that would serve future books as well as current ones. Cather believed a long-term strategy like this one would serve a writer like her, one who wished to create distinctive works of literature, and one who appreciated a publisher who showed her personal respect. Cather was planning to publish her fifth novel, Houghton Mifflin, but as she was working on it, Knopf offered to reissue some of the stories that were published in her first collection, The Troll Garden. She agreed, and in 1920, Knopf published Youth in the Bright Medusa, a collection of stories that featured four of the Troll Garden stories and four new stories. True to form, Knopf made a lovely book with a distinctive green cover and pushed it hard. She made money. This book of reissued short stories made as much in 6 months as her big novel, My Antonia, had made in its first year. Knopf's performance with this book so impressed her that though she felt some misgivings at leaving Houghton Mifflin, she decided to let Knopf publish her next novel, One of Ours, in 1922. It had terrific sales and won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Alfred Knopf would be her publisher for the rest of her life, and the firm's commitment to her created space for her to become the novelist that she became in the 1920s, the author of an amazing series of masterpieces, including A Lost Lady, The Professor's House, and Death Comes for the Archbishop. Next to writing her novels, Edith Lewis wrote, "Willa Cather's choice of Alfred Knopf as a publisher influenced her career, I think, more than any other action she ever took."
What so pleased Cather in the review of My Antonia that I mentioned earlier was this quotation. "You pick up My Antonia to read a novel, love story, of course, hope it's a good one, and find yourself enthralled by autobiography." That final phrase, "enthralled by autobiography," captures Cather's growing public persona after My Antonia, as Andy said. The praise it got was effusive and broad. With the move to the Knopfs and with their promotion of Youth in the Bright Medusa and One of Ours and its Pulitzer Prize, her profile rose significantly. Newspapers sought her out, and she told her own story. She gave speeches and taught one summer at Redloaf. She was noted and feted. In short, during the early 1920s, Cather emerged as the major American novelist of that decade. An extended trip to Nebraska in 1921 produced a series of interviewed pieces that captured Cather then. In them, Cather was asked about her life in New York. In one, Miss Cather denied living in Greenwich Village, apparently concerned about connotations. And she continued by asserting that the village doesn't exist, and then adding, "How could it in these times when every cellar is empty?" As, of course, her wife saw. Despite such disclaimers, Cather well knew the village, and as we've said, lived there from 1906 to 1932. She and Lewis moved uptown to an apartment on Park Avenue. In one of her speeches, Cather advised, "Don't try to imitate New York," saying in Omaha that it and Chicago are trying to be like New York. "One thing I like about New York is that we can wear the kind of hats we like. We wear the kind of clothes that please us." That's still very true. And I say that as actually a New Yorker who's become this kind of a New Yorker a bit in the last several months. And I bought a hat that I would never have worn. And one of the best of these profile interviews, "How Willa Cather Found Herself," by Eva Mahoney, Cather describes her working life here. "In her New York home," Mahoney writes, "Miss Cather works for 3 hours a day, hours of perfect joy and happiness," she describes them. "She finds that at the end of 2 or 3 hours, she has exhausted her best efforts." This certainly describes Cather's working methods accurately, but she also took the opportunity, while she's being interviewed, to assert herself as an artist dedicated above all to her work. Mahoney writes this. She writes easily and seldom tears a paragraph or a page to pieces. She sometimes revises, but she does not fuss over her writing. "I let life flow out along the pages," says this consummate artist. Once one of ours won the Pulitzer Prize in 1923, and there's long been a view that it was really awarded for money to me. And her reputation continued rising. Kathy refused such interviews more and more. But the many she did in the early 1920s, along with the occasional strategic essay, kept her in the limelight. Beyond the Pulitzer and public pronouncements, Kathy also refashioned herself, just as she had as a short story writer, but this time as a poet, with April Twilights and Other Poems in the spring of 1923. And then had A Lost Lady serialized before it appeared as a book that fall. By then, Catherine became famous, had become famous indeed, and so she continued to be for the rest of her life.
On November 9th, 1927, Catherine wrote to a friend that she was utterly homeless. She explained, "I had to give up the apartment on Bank Street, which I loved, and where I had been for 15 years, because the new subway was, and is, building a station almost under the very house I lived in. Last winter was wrecked by noise for both Miss Lewis and me, and the construction will go on for years. Nothing for it but to get out, and all our goods are now in storage." Kevin Lewis planned to stay at the Grosvenor Hotel on Fifth Avenue, just a few blocks from 5 Bank Street, for a few weeks while they traveled and figured out their next steps. The Grosvenor Hotel would be their home address for the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. Though Kathy was a traveler for much of her life, often preferring to be in motion rather than settled at one address, these 5 years were particularly restless for her. Plans for finding a new place were delayed as losses and distractions grew. In 1928, Kathy's father died in Nebraska, and shortly thereafter, her mother had a paralyzing stroke and moved into Los Encinas Sanitarium in Pasadena, California. Kathy often visited California before her mother died in 1931, using a room at the sanitarium to write. More pleasantly, Kathy Lewis visited Quebec City in 1928, which inspired Kathy's novel Shadows on the Rock and several return visits to Quebec and a trip to France for research. While working on the historical novel during a spell in New York at the Grosvenor, imaginatively living in the 17th century French colony, Kather hung a full-size replica of the Lady and the Unicorn tapestries at the foot of her bed, providing an alternative to the empty hotel walls. During this limbo period at the Grosvenor Hotel, Kather Lewis kept many of their things in storage, including lots of their books. And it was during this period of restlessness and homelessness that Kather Lewis found respite in the New York Society Library. Then at its location at 67 University Place around the corner from the hotel, the Society Library gave Catherine Lewis access to books for pleasure and for research. Librarian Marion King provided resources for Catherine as she worked on her historical novels, and she recommended titles to her. King hilariously recalled that the plain-spoken Catherine, when browsing the stacks of books, would say, "It's easy enough to see what you don't want to read." In 1932, the years of homelessness ended. Though Catherine Lewis would never find another place that suited them as well as 5 Bank Street, they did find considerable comfort on the Upper East Side at 570 Park Avenue. I remember the pleasure Willa Cather got from being reunited with all the humble things buried so long in storage vaults, Lewis recalled. It was like beginning to really live again.
One of the things I've learned during my own brief association with the New York Society Library is that Catherine Lewis's apartment at 570 Park Avenue was 7D. It's written on the charging card, the membership they shared here. That card is now outside this room in an exhibition here. As we've said, they moved uptown in late 1932 after the 5 disquieting years at the Grosvenor on Lower Fifth Avenue. The move from Bank Street had been forced and tentative, and actually Andy just told you all that, so I'll skip over it, although here's a good quotation, right? But on Park Avenue, it's at the corner of 63rd, just behind the Colony Club, Kathy tells a correspondent. They had material comfort, and one certainly supposes the serene quiet that Kathy so valued. As I've looked about the neighborhood, though, I've also discovered that just across the street from their building is a landmark Christian Science church at 583 Park. It was built in 1927, so it was relatively new when Catherine Lewis moved in. This is notable, at least to me. because its presence reminds of something the young Cather wrote to Annie Adams Fields, probably during the time she was in Boston at work on the Eddie book for McClure's. Telling her of a visit she had just made to a mutual friend's house, Cather writes, "I am a haunted creature. I begin to think. In the Dutch room, there is a portrait of Mary Tudor, which looks so much like Mrs. Eddy that I positively fled." Coming and going from 570 Park, walking about, Catherine was doubtless reminded of her younger self and of her own, I think, important work on Christian Science. During the years on Park Avenue, Catherine lived quietly, absorbing her losses, worrying over the fate of the world. She saw friends and still enjoyed much of what the city afforded. She developed a deep and abiding friendship with the famed violinist and his family. And his family, seeing a great deal of them here. And as we know, Cather frequented this very library during those years. She was spotted then, as in this building, then among the patrons by a very young journalist living in New York who was doing research into his Civil War kinfolk, a subject that Cather had herself once done. One day she had just emerged from this library in a beautiful sable coat, which she almost never took off. And this journalist, also just emerging, spotted her on the street trying to hail a cab in a snowstorm. Truman Capote approached her. They talked, and he offered to walk her home. She agreed. Outside a restaurant, she said, "I can use a cup of tea, could you?" They talked literature. She asked about the writers he admired, and he mentioned some European. She then asked about Americans. He named some, and then added, "And I love Willa Cather." And name some of her novels. "I ought to tell you," she paused in a Russian voice. More or less whispered, "I love those books." As they parted in front of 570 Park, Catherine invited Capote to dinner and asked to see some of his writings. He was there with alacrity. He met a discreetly elegant woman named Edith Lewis. And they dined in 7D. Capote wrote that the two women were so alike, one could be certain that they had decorated the apartment together. There were flowers everywhere, masses of winter lilac, pins and lavender-covered roses, and colored roses. Beautifully bound books lined all the walls of the living room. Willa Cather, still in the garden.
On April 24th, 1947, Willa Cather died in her apartment at 570 Park Avenue. She hadn't been feeling well for some time, but she wasn't an invalid. She was still actively working on a novel, one called Hard Punishment, that would never be completed. And she liked to do useful things, like walk to the hardware store to buy a mop. She decided to rest in her room for a while that Thursday afternoon, and about 3 o'clock came out and said she was feeling quite ill and had a terrible headache. She was dead of a cerebral hemorrhage in the hour. Early the next week, members of Cather's family joined Edith Lewis and other friends in New York for a simple funeral. The service was intimate. Just 24 people gathered in their Park Avenue apartment. Cather's body was next to the windows, surrounded by flowers. Her niece, Mary Virginia Mellon, had taken all the bows off the flowers, as she knew Cather hated those bows. The Unitarian minister who had conducted services for Edith Lewis's mother was called to lead, and he offered a dignified reading and prayer. He wanted to read a passage from Cather's work at the service, but Lewis asked him to please just read from the Bible, which he did. After the service, Edith Lewis invited a few people that knew Cather and Lewis very well to stay for tea, including Cather's longtime secretary, Sarah Bloom, and her niece, Virginia Cather Brockway. The women sat and talked near Cather's body. "It really did not seem at all inappropriate for Aunt Willie to be present," Virginia Brockway wrote, "though it does sound odd." Then on April 29th, 1947, a small group took Cather's body to Jaffrey, New Hampshire for burial. Willa Cather had left New York for the last time. Thank you very much. Yes.
Why should Barry's in New Hampshire and not Nebraska?
I'll start and then you pick up my pieces. So she loved to go to the Shattuck Inn in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, almost every fall for 20, 30 years. She loved to go and write there, and she saw it as a very meaningful retreat. And at some point during that time, she decided that she loved the cemetery there at the foot of Mount Monadnock so much that she wanted to be buried in that cemetery, which she thought was a really lovely spot. And so she just made that choice as a place that she loved. There were other members of her family, a brother who was not buried in Nebraska, right? Isn't Douglas out in California? Yeah. And so there wasn't a sense that all the Cathers went and got buried in Nebraska. So she picked the spot that she liked best.
But make no mistake about it, people in Nebraska have noticed. the other thing I think it's interesting about where she rests is that there's been a long controversy, which I think has been put to rest, but because Lewis is now, Lewis died in 1972. But the interesting thing to me is not so much that the two of them are buried together, but the fact that they, along with, I believe, a couple of people from the family that ran the inn where she stayed, the Shattuck Inn, are the only modern burials in that particular graveyard. That graveyard is essentially a colonial graveyard. It's a singular, and she has her view of Monadnock. You can look off and see it.
This picture right here was, that I believe that's Mount Monadnock behind her in this picture. It's hard to tell for sure, but when I looked from the spot near where the Shattuck Inn was, it no longer exists, that line of mountain was visible there, and so we believe that's where the picture was taken.
And there's another element in this too, and that is I like to tell students when I'm teaching Catherine, talking about Catherine Muir, is that I always say, well, it's before air conditioning. And so one of the things you saw was that she went to the Shattuck Inn, but usually she went to the Shattuck Inn after she and Lewis had been at their place on Grand Banan, which they started in New Brunswick, which they started going to in the early 1920s. And so in some ways, there's a certain logic to it, that she would spend the fall in New England, and then, once winter started settling in, that's when she would come back to New York.
I said a comment, Scott. Cather also didn't ever go back to Red Cloud after 1931, I think.
Yes.
And she also just hated the fact that this town was changing, and she wanted it to be the way she remembered it in her childhood. So, and she didn't have any family left. She basically didn't come back for the last 16 years.
That's right. It was right after her mother died. Her mother died in California, but then she was buried in Red Cloud. And after that, Cather never came back to Red Cloud again. Though she talked about it sometimes. There were some efforts to get her there, but she said she was too heartbreaking for her to go back. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I wonder if her early experience in Pittsburgh, when she attended
Oh yes, there's a sculpture that she uses in the sculptor's funeral.
Right, it's so poignant, that sense of a great artist, in her mind, a great artist. She courts him as a boy from Nebraska, coming back to a small town just like Red Cloud, and nobody really values him.
I definitely believe in the last decade of her life especially, she was, did not have faith that the future would share her values and would value who she was. And I think she had a distorted vision in those last 10 years of her life. I mean, the fact that we're sitting here right now shows that she was wrong. She was quite, she saw more skepticism out there in the crowd than she saw welcome, I think, or around in certain places. She feared that anyway.
I have a literary question. I recently read Maya Antonia after an absence of many years or something, and not remembered that it was a story within a story within a story. And I wondered, was she simply adapting a kind of 19th century frame, or was there a reason why you have a woman telling a story that a man has told to her in
largely the point that I was getting at when I was talking about her the writing of my autobiography, and then the writing of my Antonia. Notice, of course, it's the same letters. I don't want to go too much into the detail, but the interesting thing about that is, just as you say, she begins a frame narration. There's this introduction where a person is writing who sounds rather like Cabin, describes Jim Burton, right? Says that the two of them are making a pact, because they're talking about My Antonia on a Train. They made a pact to write down what they remembered about her, okay? And he says, this is the 1918 introduction, I don't know why you've never written about Antonia. Then he shows up at her apartment with a manuscript, right, which he writes Anthony on the front. And he wrote, okay. Well, the point there, I think, is that each of those people were writing their memories of Antonia to the other, okay, not to you, but to me or to him, right, but to this other person who also knew Antonia. So that's why I'm talking about empathy, right? Because it seems to me that if you look at her narrative approach prior to My Antonia, right, it's pretty much straight omniscient, third person, okay? My Antonia is the one where she makes a shift and really, as that reviewer said, which is why I think she was so pleased with it. At one point, I thought she might have written the review herself, but I haven't been able to prove that, alas. But uses the phrase enthralled by autobiography, right? Because you think that all this really happened, the reviewer says it at another place. It isn't like reading a novel where you know that this is a conventional form that the writer is just following, okay? That she's really shaken down, okay? And it seems to me that that's what she does, and I think the reason that she does that is because she had this experience with McClure, and I'm one Capra scholar who probably thinks it's more important than other ones do, but he's wrong.
I'm not going to argue with that.
Sorry.
I was going to throw in a couple other details that I think you can take them or leave them. This, as Bob said, was her first novel to be written in the first person, and she made a decision to write it from a first-person male perspective. And there is a sense that the introduction kind of gave her the way into doing that. She set it up with a character that she created, and the introduction allowed her the space, I guess, to do that. Later in her life, she would write from a male perspective and make no frame narrative like that to set it up. It's almost like she knew how to do it now and could do it differently. She also said in a letter that it was important that the reader know that Jim Burton had a rather disappointing life later on. And I think this is when her editor, Ferris Greenslip, wanted her to edit that introduction for a new edition in 1926.
He wanted her to drop it.
He wanted to drop it altogether, and he got her to cut it down until they'd have a new text so they could sell it with a special new price. But she said, I want it to be in there because the reader needs to know he had a rather unfulfilling later life. And I think what she's alerting us to there is the perspective the whole novel is in is a highly personal one, with a personal story, and that was part of her creation, was creating that perspective of that character. And so she set up this mechanism to do that.
And also, Will Jones, she commented, because he asked her about why she had taken that particular narrative approach, and she mentioned that she had, the work of doing McClure's autobiography had taught her that she could do it.
Yeah. Yes.
Didn't she also, her first approach to a lost lady?
Yes. Yes, and she rewrote it in the third person, though a lot of it is in the perspective of Neil.
You read it in
the right, but it is.
Actually, there's a first-person narrator there. She uses two first-person pronouns on the first page, right? And then steps back. So, See, and I think this is all of a piece, right? And I think it leads to what I said about Tom Alton's story in The Professor's House, because I think what she does there is actually close the frame narration. Because the other thing she said about my Antonia was that it had faults in it, and she knew where those faults were. Well, one of the faults, I think, is that she never closed the frame narration. Whereas in The Professor's House, because of the way she structures it, she does close the frame narration.
We need a question right now.
Business Against Malay, Lola Ridge, and Mabel Dodge all had soirees at the same time that Catherine.
Yes.
Who did Catherine invite to these?
Okay, so, there's a lot of things there. She was new to Mabel Dodge Lewin, when she was Mabel Dodge Lewin, for sure, and was friends with her. We know they connected in the Southwest, but they very well may have connected in New York. This just hasn't been proven, but the first letter to Mabel is very familiar, like, I've known you for a while. It's not like, let me introduce myself. So the Cather did have Friday teas at her place at 5 Bank Street, and there was a wide range of people invited to those. A lot of other writers would come. A few names that come to mind are Pitt Sanborn, who's a music critic in town. Help me out, Bob.
Henry Canby.
Oh, yeah, Henry Seidel Canby and his wife, Mary Canby. But also just people she met who were friends with her. Yeah, the cops would come. I think Lorna Burtwell was one who was a young woman that she met while she was teaching the Breadloaf School in 1922, and who then did some writing herself, but also Cather became friendly with, and she would come to the teas as well. So it was a pretty, Cather was not like Mabel Dodge in wanting to organize a bunch of famous people to interact in ways that would spark things. She was more like, oh, we're buddies, let's come on over and hang out. You know, that's my sense of it.
But yet at the same time, one of the things that I was talking to somebody in Nebraska about, I don't know, maybe it was you. The thing is that she paid close attention to what was going on. I mean, she knew what Gertrude Stein was doing in Paris, and she knew who was hanging out there. And so she really did pay attention. She had her own circle, but she also was very, very well informed. And not in genuine interest, I don't think for any particular reason.
Yes, question over there.
I thought I'd just share with you the legacy of 82 Washington Place.
Oh, good.
Richard Wright lived there.
Yeah.
William Steig lived there. Susan Sontag lived there. Linda Lavin lived there. And Phoebe Snow got evicted from there.
It's a good address. Yes. In her life, it's interesting to note that it came out in 1926, My Mortal Enemy. It's a short book, and real meditation on dark themes, certainly. The book before it was The Professor's House, arguably also quite dark in its view, but the book that followed it was Death Comes to the Archbishop. And that, I think, arguably has a very kind of different worldview in it, one that has much more joy in it, I think. So what's operating her mind? I don't subscribe to the reading that some biographers have done, that she was herself going through a kind of psychological crisis. I think instead she was interested in some of those themes as literary themes and had known other people who influenced her to write about these very dark and straight scene kind of topics that she wrote about in Professor's House of My Mortal Enemy.
What I meant by that is that she opens My Antonia with an introduction written by this person who's not identified but sounds like a writer, okay? Well, that person never comes back, okay? Right? Whereas in the professor's house, where I think she actually closes it, is what she does is she sets Godfrey St. Peter's story on either side of Tom Alvin's story, which is told in the first person. And she also makes it clear that the story that Tom Alvin is telling, he tells to Godfrey St. Peter one night when the two of them are alone and St. Peter's family is away. The comment I'd make on Mun Mor is that, I think Andy's absolutely right about dark themes. It actually, if I could pause for a moment and offer a Andy Jewell commercial. I just recently read an article, Andy's in biography, where he's looking at Cather in the 1930s and 40s, a period when it's been very common to say that she was depressed. And while certainly you can talk about how she felt about the state of the world at the time, you make a very compelling case that it, as I said, much more complicated than just that. If you remember the Henshaws, they had this kind of fairy tale meeting and marriage, and she ran away with him, and it was true love, and someday my prince will come, and all that stuff. And then, of course, it becomes a marriage just like anybody else. Okay.
Yeah, a little worse than that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I understand that I'm the McClure guy, but the thing is, that's exactly what happened to S.S. McClure and his wife, Patty. Okay. Part of the reason that he got kicked out as editor was that he had been having an affair with just an atrocious poet. by the name of Florence Wilkinson. And one of the things I've been doing while I've been here, I've been going through the paper McClure's because my university doesn't have them. And so I've read all of the poems, and she has lots. And this is a magazine which is publishing Houseman and Yeats at the same time. And she's going, actually, I inflicted one of her poems on Brooklyn Bridge on my students. This is one of my students. Right, and it's a wretched poem. All right. Well, he's having this affair with her, and then everybody finds out about it. And Ida Tarbell and others get outraged. Well, the Henshaws probably are based on McClure's marriage. And what's that? No, he's not. But the thing is that this was a marriage that was, had gone down and was not going to come back. And so the thing is that she as managing editor was put in the position of knowing all this stuff, whether she wanted to or not. So I see where she got the material.
Maybe one more question, and then we can talk afterwards. Harriet, I saw your hand first, but we can talk afterwards. Go ahead.
I have several questions on Macon too, but if you could summarize her changing relationship to New York City, and also her attitude about her increasing fame.
I think as she grew older, more successful, she grew more impatient with New York, but she never left. And I think she never left. She grew impatient with what people grow impatient with urban, major urban areas, the noise, the hassle, all that kind of thing. But she never left making New York her permanent address for a couple of reasons. I think her publisher was here, and there were really important professional connections to her. More importantly, I think, is because Edith Lewis had a great job at the J. Walter Thompson advertising firm. And though Cather said many times casually to friends over the years, oh, maybe I'll move to California, maybe I'll move to New Mexico, she never did. And I think part of the reason is because she didn't want to leave Edith Lewis, who had a great job and didn't want to leave. So Cather did spend a lot of time outside of the city. In fact, there are years where she is in the city a lot less than she's somewhere else. And so she managed her attitudes that way. And do you want to talk about fame?
Sure. What was the question? I'm sorry.
How she dealt with her increasing fame.
I think she accepted it and embraced it. One of the
depends on when it was.
Yeah, I mean, I love her work. I'm serious about her work. I long have been, but I'm a Catholic skeptic. Okay, I'm working right now on her the scholarly edition of her poems. In part, and this is how I got into McLeod. I'm basically working on Catherine after she leaves Nebraska until about 1918. Okay, because it seems to me that that's when the real interesting stuff happened. Okay, some of you may know her essay, My First Novels. There were two. Right, we just alluded to that. Okay, this was published in 1931 in a very fine publication called The Colophon, and in which they asked a whole series of writers to talk about the first time they got into print. So the theme was getting it into print. And almost no one, including Catherine, actually answered that question. Okay, that is, they wrote about whatever they chose to write about, but not when they first published. Anyway, in that essay, she talks about those first two novels and how she, you know, embarked on the road that made her Willa Cather, in a way which I've always said is rather like the ascension to heaven. Okay? Right? Of course, I'm Willa Cather. And I think that and part of that, and you know, we have here one of the co-editors of the letters by it, right? Who I mean, if you wanted to, we could talk about the letters. But the thing is
I want to.
but the thing is that, you know, I mean, she put a codicil in her will, and she didn't want people to publish them, and they, you know, various other things. And fair enough that she wanted people to read her work. Okay, and that, again, I think that's fair enough. But what she's also doing by that essay is offering her version of how she became the writer she became. That is, how she got to fame. And for a long time, those of us on the side of the podium just kind of accepted that. And when you look at it, actually scrutinize it, as I say, the story is a whole lot more interesting because it is part of the story that we told you here tonight.
I was under the impression of the letter showed that she became increasingly about fame and about me.
There is a part of her life, and it is the most famous part of her life in many ways, like the last decade or so, 15 years, where she has a lot of statements to her publisher and others about wanting to be left alone a little bit, or not wanting to do lectures, etc. It depends on where you look at her, at different parts of her life, because I agree with Bob, she definitely embraced her fame, sought it, strategized to get it. Once she had it, she didn't want to just relish it, she didn't want more fame. You know, what I really think she wanted the respectability of being a major artist. She wanted to also to be able to support herself professionally doing the kind of work she wanted to do. Once she got those two things, she didn't need more. She didn't want to be more famous, more rich. She was sort of done and like wanted to keep doing her work and have the space to do so and be left alone. And I think that's what success meant to her later in her life, was to be able to, as she did many times throughout her life, choose to live the way she wanted to live, right? So I think that those choices, though, especially as an established writer, depended on her already being famous. So it's not as if she hated the fame. The fame gave her the ability to not say yes to everything, if that makes sense.
So that when she walked into New York Society Library the first time in 1928 and said to Marianne King, my name is Catherine, and I'm by the way of being a writer. She knew perfectly well that somebody like King would see the gap between what she said and what she was, because she was, you know, certainly was that person.
And in the story about Truman Capote is another one where you know she is enjoying this young writer's admiration of her and can't resist saying, well, that's me. And of course, it's very
good. And that piece was published in Vanity, republished, I think, in Vanity Fair in 2006. It's very easy to Google. Right? Yeah, but it's a great piece.
Well, you've been very kind, and we'll stay around.